We built an impressive civilization, we human beings, but there are a few things we ignored along the way, and that's often been to our peril. What is it about us that makes it so hard for us to learn from lessons and plan adequately for the future, especially at a time in history when it appears critical that we think ahead? These are among the central questions in a new book by Bina Venkataraman called The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Bina Venkataraman worked as a journalist for the New York Times and Boston Globe, was a senior advisor on climate change innovation in the Obama White House, and now directs the Global Policy Initiative for MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Harvard. Bina, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
Just reading your bio, it's clear you spent a lot of time thinking about the future. Have you often been frustrated by the way that people don't seem to heed warnings?
Well, I have been. I've even been frustrated by myself because sometimes I'll have very clear warning signs, clear predictions of the future, and not be able to take the actions necessary to make a good decision on behalf of my future self. So I think it's a common, tendency that humans have, but I'd hate to call it an inevitability. And in fact, the research I've done over the last 5 years, finding examples from all over the world, mining empirical evidence from a number of fields of science, has shown that it's a myth that human beings are just cursed to being short-sighted, that we're just inevitably only going to do what's right in front of us and most alluring. We actually, in fact, have the capacity for great foresight, and that is why we've been able to do things like build civilization, put humans on Mars, and you know, even do things like save for our own future.
Well, but as you point out, as you're doing other things, though, the sorts of, you know, I mean, we like to plan for positive things like that. Let's do this, that sort of thing. Let's go on vacation, as you point out in the book. But when it comes to paying attention to some of the negative things along the way, it seems like that's where we kind of let up. And you have your own example in the book about ignoring a bug bite. What'd you find out down the road?
Well, it turned out this bug bite was no innocent mosquito bite that would just disappear in a few days, though it didn't have much sign of being worse at the beginning. It was a tick bite that I got several years ago when I was hiking in the woods in Hudson Valley in New York, and it turned into a rash, and it was kind of an ugly rash, but after a few days it subsided, and I kind of forgot about it and decided I wouldn't go to the doctor because I was really busy. I was working in the White House, and I was keeping really long hours, and just seemed inconvenient to take a break and, you know, go to the doctor, one of those short-term decisions we're all prone to make. And then, you know, 8 months later, this bacterial infection, Lyme disease, had spread throughout my body, and I had a knee swollen to the size of a grapefruit. And I thought to myself, as I went through the long course of getting treated, and I'm lucky enough that I was treated, and I'm doing much better now, but I thought to myself, how could I have been so stupid? How could I have ignored these warning signs? And it coincided with a long professional challenge around trying to get people who lead companies, for example, to heed warning signs about future drought and wildfire and flood with the warming climate. My work in part on the response to the Ebola epidemic, realizing that even public health officials who'd been trained to look at the warning signs of how that outbreak could spread into the epidemic it became, how they really just neglected to imagine those futures that were possible, including that epidemic. And I think you're right to raise this issue about how we avoid negative futures. I think sometimes we both neglect the potential for negative outcomes, but we also have the tendency in some instances to not be able to imagine what's positive. And in a lot of our conversations today about climate change, I think we're lacking the ability to imagine a world that where we actually do something to address this problem. So we need positive visions as well. But to go back to the issue around how we avoid negative futures, one of the stories I tell in the book is about the police psychologist who was advising the Olympic Organizing Committee in Munich leading up to the 1972 Munich Olympics. And this particular psychologist was trained as a double agent, actually. He would protest with student groups and in the 60s, and then he would also go and report to the police on their whereabouts. And his whole idea was to create predictable circumstances so there wouldn't be some big conflict that erupted between police and student protesters. So it was kind of his job to think about future scenarios. And when the committee asked him to come up with scenarios of things that could go wrong at the Olympics, he, in fact, came up with, among the scenarios, a scenario that involved terrorists climbing over the Olympic Village's fence at dawn and taking hostage Israeli athletes. And he had some reasons for coming up with this scenario, but he was actually ignored. And one of the reasons he was ignored, if you look back at this history and in the story I tell, is that the Olympic organizers were really keen on having an Olympics they were branding as cheerful and carefree, and they really wanted to have that outcome. And so they sanitized his scenario, which ended up being what happened. And in fact, there was a massacre, as we know, of Israeli athletes who were taken hostage in a very similar situation to what Georg Zeber, this psychologist, had predicted.
Which reminds me of the warnings about people who were in flight schools and didn't seem to have any interest in doing things other than just to fly the plane once they're ready in the air, which had somebody, I believe, finally reported to the FBI. I'm concerned people are going to fly planes into buildings. And the response from FBI headquarters was that's not going to happen.
Right. And I think in a lot of these circumstances, what we don't want to happen, we don't allow ourselves to imagine. And so one of the things I talk about in the book are tools that communities, groups, and even individuals can use to actually imagine futures of all kinds, both positive and negative. And in the case of groups and sort of organizations, one of the tactics that I found has worked in a number of cases is to create sort of role-play games. So these are similar to war games that are used at the Pentagon, which I looked at closely, but they're also used by communities, for example, and trying to think through what does this community look like if we make certain decisions as the sea level rises? How are our storms going to look? What's our sewer going to look like? Our sewage infrastructure going to look like if we don't make any different decisions and we face rising seas along our coastline? And the thing about these games that's interesting is that they allow people to inhabit a future scenario without being exactly convinced that it's the one that's going to happen. You kind of ask them to suspend disbelief to play the game, the way we do when we play a game of Monopoly or we play old board games like Clue, which I love. So the idea is that this suspension of disbelief can be very helpful for helping us see how our decisions affect the future.
For the people who do say, well, it's just human nature to not think ahead of what's in front of us, what do you say, Bina?
Well, one of the things that I thought going into this project was that it was just human nature. In fact, it was a big source of frustration when I was in the White House trying to work with companies to get them to think ahead about climate change. I would find over and over again, they would say, well, we're really just beholden to our board and shareholders who want us to focus on the quarter. And, oh, it's just human nature was kind of an accepted part of that exchange. But as I started to probe the evidence around this, even research studies, so you go back to the sort of classic study around delayed gratification and instant gratification, which is the marshmallow test, which was first done in the 60s and by Walter Michel, where he gave kids the option of taking one treat right away, like a marshmallow or pretzel, whatever their favorite treat was, and the option of waiting for an indeterminate amount of time for the second treat. And those who waited for the second treat, he later found in his studies, had a high rate of achievement in terms of SAT scores and graduating from college, things like this. And unfortunately, the picture that painted for a lot of parents, a lot of the media, all of us, was that there are just some kids who are really good at waiting for the second marshmallow, and those kids are going to be high-achieving and do well in life. And then there are just some of us who would just eat the second marshmallow right away, and we're kind of doomed. We're just short-sighted, and we're impulsive. And what really emerges when you look at the body of evidence around this test that has happened since the initial test and even sort of simultaneously but was more in the shadows, is that environment and norms and culture make a huge difference on whether kids wait for that second marshmallow. If kids are in a peer group where they're told that the other peers are also waiting or also indulging, they'll tend to converge to that norm. If the kids feel it's trustworthy that the adult's going to bring them that second treat, they can set the conditions in a way that kind of tests this, those kids will wait. And so what's really interesting to me about this is that if you look at this context and the context of some other studies in cognitive science, you really see how we have a number of choices. And those choices can actually be tweaked by organizations, by business leaders to change how, for example, doctors prescribe antibiotics, often seen to be very short-term. And it can be changed by institutions and collective agreements. So I've looked at fisheries where fishermen have actually come together and ended the so-called tragedy of the commons of overfishing until the stock collapses, and instead they've been able to protect their fishery like a shared heirloom that they're going to pass on to their collective children and grandchildren in their community. And I found this in the Gulf of Mexico with the red snapper fishermen and also along the Pacific coast of Mexico, where I studied a lobster fishery.
But we've learned the hard way, it seems like, more often than not over the course of thousands of years. For example, you talk about growing annual crops in the ancient Middle East having a role in our Dust Bowl in the 1930s here. What, and in what way?
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting example, because what I'm not saying is that we can predict everything that will happen in the long-range future. And I certainly don't think that the first farmers 10,000 years ago who first cultivated crops knew what they were doing that would have a hand in the Dust Bowl. But the meaning of that statement is really that we, as a species, you know, our ancestors, when they stopped being hunter-gatherers or as they were evolving to be farmers and becoming building agrarian societies, they chose to cultivate annual grains instead of perennial grains. And today we still cultivate mostly annual grains when you think about corn, wheat, sorghum, soy, all of these crops. And in fact, annual grains, it makes sense that they would do this because it was easier to repropagate them year after year, or if you were moving in those initial transitions from a hunter-gatherer community to a farming community, that would be more stationary. But in fact, this way of growing grains is not inevitable. It's a choice. It's sort of an infrastructure and a way of thinking and a habit that we've locked into our history of farming. But it can be very wasteful. So annual crops tend to have shallow roots. They require replanting. We lose a lot of fertile topsoil around the world because of this method of farming, particularly in monocultures of wheat and corn and sorghum. And what I did was I spent some time with a farmer and scientist named Wes Jackson in Kansas, who's actually trying to rethink this whole model of how we grow crop grains. And he has collaborated with other scientists at a place called the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, where they're developing perennial grains and a sort of methodology for agriculture that involves growing grains that will not just have good yields in the short term to sort of feed the market imperative, feed people, also help farmers stay afloat, but will replenish and protect fertile topsoils so that in a warming climate where we're losing lots of our soils, where we're facing drought, where pests are increasingly a problem on farms, where increasingly floods are also a problem in certain regions, those crops can be more resilient as well as feed the growing world population.
Bina Venkataraman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. And so we get to one of the major points of the book, which is having good information. So it's information gathering versus judgment. Do we often ignore the information and just put our gut judgment on it?
Well, it's interesting. You started with the weather forecast before we started talking and telling people it was probably going to rain today. And so that's a really classic example of predictions that we rely upon all the time for the pretty short-range future, right? So we usually look at the weather forecast the day before or the morning of and decide what we're going to do. And it's in that moment that we take the weather forecast, which we tend to trust because it's one of those short-term forecasts that's pretty reliable, and then we decide, okay, am I going to bring an umbrella to work today, or am I going to wear a rain jacket? Am I going to ride my bike? So all of those questions involve some judgment. We're thinking about the information we have, and with the information we have, as well as our own tolerance for risk, our own values, we make a decision about what to do. And in the case of the weather forecast, it's a lot simpler because of that time frame. And as we get into predictions that show us more of the distant future or show us a more complex picture of the future or require us to make decisions that require a little more sacrifice than just bringing an umbrella to work, that's when we need more judgment. That's when we need more help to balance that information and understand how to use it. And what I argue is we're living in a society that is obsessed with prediction. And in fact, this probably goes back to reading oracle bones in ancient times or reading crystal balls. We love to be able to predict the future. We want to know the future. And it's understandable because we face anxiety about the future. We're uncertain about it. But that information alone is not enough to serve us to make good decisions about the future. We also need to hone these capacities for imagination and foresight. And we often are neglecting that, and hurricane forecasting is a good example of that. Of course, we just saw a devastating Hurricane Dorian come through the Bahamas and up the Atlantic coast. But certainly this happens around the world, where people who are equipped with very good forecasts will often do little more than buy bottled water, even if they have the resources, even if they own storm shutters. They will not act in advance of a forecast. And if you look at the science, the research behind why people do this, you come to see a picture wherein people if they haven't actually experienced a disaster, they haven't actually experienced the situation you're predicting for them, it's very difficult for them to actually vividly imagine that and prepare for that. Unlike an experience you have recently had, which can scar you and sort of become all you're planning for. So we need bridges for our imagination in this sense, and I think it's really important as we think about predicting the future or warning people of what lies ahead to spend as much time honing those techniques of imagination and foresight.
But right to the issue of hurricanes, you tell us of a doctor in the book, Jay Segarra, who didn't heed hurricane warnings in Mississippi. Why not?
Well, he didn't think it would be that bad. And he was living in Ocean Spring, Mississippi, and he ended up clinging to the roof of his house during Hurricane Katrina in 100-mile-per-hour winds. And it was a harrowing experience. He lost family photos. He saw his cello, which was an heirloom cello he had inherited that had been built in Paris in 1890, played by his father. He saw it floating away down the street. He did recover it, but it, you know, was ultimately almost completely destroyed. And so why is it that someone like that, he was actually well-versed in the science and knew that this was going to be a bad hurricane in the sense that he had the predictions, he was watching the radar forecast, but he really didn't imagine how difficult, how much of a struggle it would be to survive that hurricane. And if he had, he says he would have made decisions differently. There's another component to that as well, which is that he talks about how, you know, the government made him whole again. He was able to rebuild his home with the help of public services. And of course, after a disaster, we all expect and hope that government programs will help us to recover. And in fact, that's the humane thing to do, to respond to a humanitarian disaster like a hurricane. But it's not that simple in the sense that often what we're doing with some of these programs and policies that we have choices around collectively in society is reinforcing and encouraging people not to think ahead. And so we can't put it all on the individuals. We really have to look at some of these policy choices we're making collectively and really hold our politicians accountable for that.
So in Jay Segarra's case, he rebuilt where he was because there was a program that would allow him to rebuild where he was.
Right. In that case, exactly. He rebuilt his home right in that same spot, and he really didn't face much trouble. Now, in Katrina, or after Katrina, I should say, there were a number of people, particularly from poorer communities in New Orleans proper, in Louisiana, not Mississippi, who struggled to get the resources to rebuild. So, of course, this is an issue of equity as well, but I think it's really important to recognize that in many instances, there are policies and laws on the books that are encouraging us to build and rebuild in areas that are prone to disaster. And an example of this is a home that's been rebuilt in Texas something like 19 times at a cost to the taxpayers in a flood zone. And we really have to look at cases like this and be trying to help people relocate and trying to think about ways that we can build communities in a much more safe way with an eye to the future.
Bina Venkataraman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, former journalist, now at the Global Policy Initiative for MIT and Harvard. Her book is The Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. You can join us on the Exchange, thinking about the future and how we adapt to the future. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Our whole thing with instant gratification, though, is a strong one. I mean, we talked about the marshmallow experiment and its various iterations and redos over the years. But as you point out, if you're trying to lose weight, the donut is right there in front of you, and the scale with 10 fewer pounds is not here and not now. I mean, how do we change our focus from what's directly, I mean, imagination, I guess, is what you've said already.
Right, and imagination is a technique that can help a lot with this. So if you think about it, yes, you can smell the donut, you can touch the donut, and so it's right there in front of you. You don't smell, touch, or hear the future. It's a figment of your imagination. So you have to kind of give it some help if you want to be able to imagine that future. And some of the techniques that, for example, Walter Michel found that worked with some of the kids who actually did do well on that marshmallow test was if they imagined the particular thing they were craving as something else. They might imagine that really delicious-looking donut as a cloud floating away, something a little less hot, something cool is how he would describe it. But there are also techniques to try to bring into focus the future outcome that you think you want to avoid or that you want to steer toward. And one of the techniques that I talk about in the book is called perspective hindsight, or it was called this by Deborah Mitchell. And it's this idea of imagining a future outcome you want. Maybe it's, you know, a dinner party that went really well, or maybe it's a contract you negotiated at work. It could be any kind of outcome. And it could also be an outcome you really don't want to have happen, for that matter, and I really encourage that as well. And then what you do is you pretend that the outcome has already happened, and you walk back from that, and you try to ask, why did it happen, and how did it happen? And this allows you to elaborate the real reasons, the real pivotal decisions that you could influence in the present that would lead to that outcome. So if it's the dinner party, maybe it's that the conversation was really likely. Okay, really lively. That tells you that you need to invite a certain kind of guest, or that it doesn't really matter so much what the weather forecast is. It matters more who you have at the table and what questions you bring up. So it's a way of trying to illuminate what's really important in the near term and how it affects an imagined future outcome. There are also techniques known as if-then techniques that are used by Peter Gollwitzer at NYU, who studied them in all kinds of contexts with all kinds of people, including people who suffer from mental illnesses. And these techniques involve thinking about the future outcome you want and then thinking about all the things that might get in the way of that outcome along the way. So if it's losing 10 pounds, maybe you think, okay, that's what I'd like to do, but tomorrow I'm going to a birthday party and there's going to be a delicious cake there. Well, what Gollwitzer would advocate and what he studied is doing something like saying, okay, if I see the cake and I really want the cake, then I will. And you fill in the blank, I will, and you make these statements, write them down, state them aloud. And they're sort of intentions. They're called implementation intentions. That's another name for them. And they allow you to make a plan for how you're going to deal with the situation of current or present temptation so that you can adhere more to your long-term goals.
So I think what I'm hearing is a lot of specificity, though. You know, if I want my dinner party to look and sound like this, I will do this. If I'm confronted with the birthday cake at the party, I will do this. But is part of the issue with things like climate change that it is so abstract and so large, for that matter, that it's hard to think of individual things that we can do?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's a little bit of a red herring to say that acting on climate change is always about individual action, whether or not you ride your bike to work, whether or not you eat that cheeseburger or go vegan. I think those decisions are meaningful, and that anyone who makes those decisions is putting a down payment on the future for future generations, is doing something that's meaningful in terms of addressing the climate crisis. But I think when it comes to climate change, we really need our institutions to act. We really need businesses to act. We need to hold them accountable. So a lot of the change that we can make at the individual level is using our power to vote, using our power to make it a political priority, for climate change to be a political priority, using our ability to influence the communities that we are involved in, the businesses we work for. There are many examples of this in the tech industry now, where workers are organizing around issues they care about. Climate change is an issue that requires people who will stand up for the future, who will make the future more important than whatever those particular imperatives are that are driving the present profit-seeking or the present priorities of politicians. And what I think we need to do as individuals when it comes to climate change is to help ourselves inhabit that future. So write letters to our future kids and grandkids, their nieces and nephews. Write letters to your future self to help yourself imagine the future. That's one technique I talk about. But then use what you get from that, which is the ability to see a future that might not be so great if we don't act on climate change, or that might be much better if we do. Use that insight to make it a priority for those we need to hold accountable to act.
Before we go completely into the organizational section of the book, I wanted to ask about one more individual story. It is from Oregon. It's about Kathleen Elwood and how she found something she lacked in herself that she wanted to change.
Yes, and I loved telling that story. And Kathleen Elwood was a principal in Oregon, and she found herself and many of her colleagues, in fact, despite having really good intentions about how they would deal with classroom discipline when a kid acts up, they were having very disproportionate effects, and by the way, this is true across the country, disproportionate effects on students of color, particularly black male students, were getting punished and sent to the principal's office more often, ending up with suspensions. And this pattern, by the way, across America, really results in a sort of handicapping and penalizing of students of color, because when they miss more classroom time because of suspensions, it's more likely to feed into what's known as the school-to-prison pipeline. So Kathleen Elwood knew all of this, and she actually deeply cares about it. She's worked on racial justice herself. As a white principal, she wanted to do something to address this, and so she got exposed to some research by Kent McIntosh and Eric Gervin, And it showed that the same technique I talked about with Peter Golwitzer, the if-then tactics that are used by people when they want to resist eating that donut, could be used to also help teachers when they're sort of prone to disproportionately punishing or sending the principal's office those kids. She found that in her K-8 school, about 90% of the kids being sent to the principal's office were Black. And, of course, that is a trend echoed nationally. And she also got exposed to the research of two University of Oregon professors, Kent McIntosh and Eric Gervin, who would call these moments where teachers disproportionately or unevenly punish students in the classroom vulnerable decision points. And so Elwood, using their research and their help, in fact, instituted a new sort of practice in the school, helping her teachers and herself identify moments in the classroom, these vulnerable decision points for teachers, where maybe the teacher is fatigued because it's been a particularly long day and they've had to skip lunch, or moments where a student who's often disruptive speaks out of turn. And so in advance, these teachers would make a plan for what they would do, how they would react, so they wouldn't react disproportionately or unfairly to certain students based on implicit bias or ideas of what that student is bound to do, or ideas that maybe don't have to do with a particular student at all in the moment. And so a teacher could make a strategy, for instance, like, well, if this particular student speaks out of turn, I'm going to put my hands behind my back and take 3 steps backwards, or I'm going to drop a pencil and take a deep breath before I react. And what she found was these simple techniques, which weren't about, by the way, really changing what the student had done or even changing the standard of what merits discipline in a school classroom, but really about that moment of impulse where we're prone to making decisions that maybe don't reflect our highest values or what we actually believe is the decision that we want to hold in the long run, that those moments, interrupting those moments by creating these if-then tactics, by creating a strategy in advance for how you would respond, it significantly dropped the number of students of color who were being sent to the principal's office. And it was helpful in that situation. And now McIntosh and Gervin are trying to study this to see if it holds true across other classrooms and schools across America.
We have been talking primarily thus far about individual actions and the ways in which we can influence the collective action, as you point out, by voting and things like that. But there's a whole section of the book that gets into corporations and organizations. And is it even worse for them to see the future based on things like the short-term focus on investor value?
Well, it is hard for some corporations to focus on the future. And I think that seeing that as an inevitability is dangerous and reckless, that in fact there are choices that corporations can make, choices that investors can make, choices that boards can make, and even policymakers to help solve and address these problems. And the way we know that is, for example, because we can look at corporations that don't do things like predict every quarter's profits. They've decided that they will get out of that cycle of just projecting ahead the quarter and then trying to meet that earning target, that they'll instead look at things like R&D or growth in market share, use other metrics to measure their success. We see that corporations are able to sometimes orient themselves more towards building future value for their shareholders and investors. And one example of that from recent history is Unilever, which under Paul Polman until last year did stop projecting its quarterly earnings. They still have to report them by law. And so one of the things that corporations can do is get off of this treadmill. I call it dashboard driving. It's a way of anchoring yourself to just those short-term targets, staring at the dashboard. What's my speed level? What's my fuel level? Instead of looking at the horizon to what really matters. And it turns out these ways of measuring and rewarding progress within companies, giving bonuses based on annual progress or quarterly process, really have a detrimental effect on detecting threats in the future and also investing in future value. It's been highly documented that companies that orient more towards the short term sacrifice research and development spending. They sacrifice opportunities all the time. And for those of us who have 401ks or pensions, they're sacrificing our savings, our futures, when they do that. And this is a pretty legal and routine practice. It's interesting, too, because I think people often get up in arms when they hear about a corporate scandal, an accounting scandal, or something like what Wells Fargo was doing with those fraudulent accounts. But more value is lost in our investment climate, in capital markets. More of all of our money is lost by the routine and legal habit that CEOs have of governing themselves by the quarter. So I look a lot in the book at ways that we can measure ourselves as leaders, ways that companies can better address what's important in the long term.
What were your thoughts about the Business Roundtable about a month ago issuing its principles of corporate governance for this year and for the first time since 1997, getting away from shareholder primacy as the main focus, wanting to be more omnivorous about who is served by a corporation?
Well, I think it's a really interesting statement. It's promising. I think, as with a lot of industry-led initiatives, the real test will be how well this is adopted, how much of it is a statement, and how much of it is something that they'll actually act upon and hold themselves accountable for. I do think it's promising, though, in the sense that once those public statements are made, journalists and others can look to see how these companies are performing. Are they actually giving more power to the shareholders that have longer-term visions that hold the stock for longer? Which is, by the way, a way to kind of square this circle around shareholder primacy, because the idea is that if you give your shareholders too much power, the idea in the ether right now is that the shareholders are going to drive you only towards short-term profits and make you do share buybacks and do things that kind of starve the company of the resources to invest in the future. And that doesn't have to be the case. A shareholder could be long-term oriented. And in fact, there are companies like Alphabet and others out there that give more voting power to shareholders that hold onto the stock for longer periods of time so that they can be influenced by the shareholder with the vision instead of the shareholder that just wants to kind of reap all the profits today. But I do think that Business Roundtable statement points to a recognition in corporate America, in the investment community, that something needs to be done about this, because it's not fun to lead an organization that's only looking at the quarter. It's not valuable, and it's not meaningful for those people's lives or for the people who work for these companies. And a company that wants to attract talent, that wants to make a real difference in the world, that wants to be a brand that can be admired, is going to orient itself more towards these future goals.
And as you point out in the book, it is not just businesses that tend to think in the short term. And one of the best examples is the overuse of antibiotics leading to superbugs. And as you remind us in the book, even Alexander Fleming, when he was coming out with penicillin, said, hey, you can't overuse this stuff because it'll get immune to what we're putting out there. But as you point out, though, federal health policy contributed to the use of the overuse of antibiotics.
That's right. In fact, this requirement, a directive that had come through from, in the U.S., the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which encouraged doctors to sort of immediately prescribe patients who were coming in for pneumonia into emergency rooms of hospitals to prescribe them antibiotics within a short window of time, which has a sort of laudable goal, which is to say, don't let people die of pneumonia, you know, make sure they get treated. Unfortunately, it encouraged and abetted what is already sort of a cultural problem, or has been a cultural problem in medicine in a lot of instances, which is this desire to give a quick fix, to give a cure. And the pressure comes from the patients who want something, they want to take away something to be treated for, a cough or a cold, for example, much less serious than a pneumonia, but obviously sometimes a suspected pneumonia. And also it comes from the doctors themselves and the sort of culture of medicine where when a lot of backlog of patients are mounting and doctors are tired, they just want to kind of move through their patients quickly. And so I looked at and documented sort of studies of how that environment encourages that short-term thinking. Because it turns out, you know, a lot of these doctors, they're very steeped in the medical science. And so they know about the rise of superbugs that are resistant to known antibiotics and that each prescription they make is contributing to that problem. But to see that individual case when you're under a lot of pressure and time constraints and fatigue as that broader question and the broader risk of future consequences is asking a lot. And so what I looked at were a number of examples in the UK and the US where, in fact, hospitals and doctor's offices have instituted ways of interrupting that moment of prescription and trying to help encourage doctors to actually be able to see those consequences. And I looked at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, for example, in Baltimore, where a team of doctors being led by the infectious disease physician Sarah Cosgrove go around the hospital. They're being dispatched to help doctors figure out when an antibiotic is actually warranted in a situation and which antibiotic for that matter so that they can curb the rise of superbugs. And the team I think of as kind of like the sailors in the Odyssey who tie Odysseus to the mast to keep him from hearing the songs of the sirens, they're kind of serving a function like that in that they go and help these physicians and nurse practitioners make more balanced decisions that bring the future consequences into focus.
And I hear again, though, a comparison with the situation with Kathleen Elwood and not overreacting to transgressions by students in school. It's about time. It's about taking a moment to be able to say, okay, wait a minute. What do I really want to do here? But that's a luxury for a lot of people. As you just point out, I mean, particularly with doctor's offices, the idea like, okay, I got more patients to deal with today. And I hear this in business after business where we would think about the future if we could just get through today.
Right. And I think that's a fair issue to raise. And it's in fact one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because I just felt that at a time where we need to think ahead more than ever, where our lifespans are getting longer, where we have problems like climate change collectively, where we need to be able to invest in the future and where we care about the future, we are yet living in a culture that's increasingly driven by the instant, where even the idea of an instant has compressed. If you trace the history of what the idea of a moment or an instant meant before, we are actually looking at instants as much shorter increments of time, and we have Google searches anticipating what we're going to say before we even finish typing in our search queries. So we are, and every business and environment is facing these set of circumstances, and in fact, every household is probably facing them as well. And I talk about how scarcity of time can be much like scarcity of money, and this is actually a point that was raised by Eldar Shafir and Sindel Mullanathan in their book, Scarcity, and I draw on some of that research for the Optimist Telescope, which is to say that when you're compressed for time, you can behave the way a person who has no money and is willing to take a fairly family heirloom to a pawn shop to sell it off because they just need to put food on the table. You can behave that way when you are pressed for time or bandwidth. And so it's really dangerous circumstances that we're often putting people in who make decisions about the future of our society, who make decisions about our lives. I mean, when we go to a doctor's office, we take a child to a doctor's office, we're putting ourselves at stake. And I think, you know, we need to sort of ask for this. And I think there are techniques that can be used. That's why I sort of brought into focus some of these techniques that create those interruptions in those moments where we're prone to making reckless decisions, because I think we all need to be able to benefit from ways to build in some of that space into how we make decisions. We're not going to get rid of the technology that's driving us to be focused on the instant, but we can create sort of what I think of as sort of islands of better consciousness for decisions that affect the future the most. We can create buffers to our impulses within our lives and within our organizations and even within our society.
So even if we can give ourselves that breathing space, back to one of the central issues of the book, to climate change itself, I mean, here again, information versus judgment. If we decided, here's what we're going to do in the future, starting now, to make sure that we don't turn the planet into a cinder, what kinds of information could we get in the short term that would indicate that we're on the right track, particularly when this stuff could take decades? If we stop, for example, using fossil fuels today, it could still take a long time for the carbon levels to drop below 400 in parts per million in the atmosphere.
Well, Jeff, you raise a really great point, which is that we sometimes need near-term rewards, or we need a way of seeing that we have milestones. That's one of the reasons why we measure incremental targets like quarterly profits so much, or why we count our steps every day if we have Fitbits. You know, we are a species that likes to get some feedback about how we're doing. And when it comes to addressing the climate crisis, it does seem like we're holding back the tides. And in fact, you know, it's not just hard to look at and observe sea level rise. You don't sort of see the sea level rising on a day-to-day basis. It's also hard to see how we might be addressing problems for the better. And I do think part of this is working at the community level and recognizing how making a community greener and cleaner and safer in terms of public health is a way of making that community better. And it's a way of bringing people together to see how they can work together. And one of the stories I tell in the book is about a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout in Mattapoisett, Massachusetts, which is a former shipbuilding town, which was sort of the companion town to New Bedford, which was the capital of whaling in North America in a previous era. And in Mattapoisett, this young Boy Scout, Jared Watson, was working with his community, fellow community members and fellow Boy Scouts to install markers around town to indicate where the sea level could rise. And it was also a way of making the community come together and tell its stories. There were people, elderly people, telling stories about former hurricanes. And there were young people talking about the future.
Okay, a chance for people to get together and talk about not just the past, but the future as well. One of the major points of the Optimist's Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. It's a work by Bina Venkataraman. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you.